You know the bit in Harry Potter? Shelley said. When Dumbledore goes something like, there comes a point where we all have to make a choice between what is right and what is easy?
I guess, Mira said.
She lifted up the tendrils of a strawberry plant to pour a dilution of tomato food into the soil. I reckon he's got it back to front, Shelley said. I was just thinking about it. Like, no one ever actually knows what the right thing to do is. I mean, you can think that you know what's right, and you can tell yourself that you know. But at the point that you make your choice, like in the moment, you're never really certain. You just hope. You just act, and you hope for the best. And maybe it turns out that you did the right thing, or maybe it turns out that you didn't. In which case, all you can say is that at least you tried. But like, the wrong thing to do, that's often much clearer. Wrong is like easier to see than right a lot of the time. It's more definite. Like, this is the line I know I will not cross. This is what I absolutely will not do.
Yeah, said Mira, I see that.
So anyway, Shelley went on, this is what I was thinking. That like, the real choices that you make in your life, the really difficult, defining choices, are never between what's right and what's easy. They're between what's wrong and what's hard.
Ha, huh, Mira said. Yeah, that's a really good point.
Shelley waited, but she didn't say anything else.
I mean, come on, Dumbledore,
Shelley added after a moment, trying to make a joke out of it. But Mira had already picked up her watering can and was walking off to another part of the field. Disappointed, Shelley turned back to the straw bale that she had been pulling apart with her hands and gave it an exaggerated grimace, and then immediately felt disloyal. She wiped her expression clean, grabbed the bale firmly with both hands, and carried on. In Shelley's time at university, she had contributed a regular book review to the English department's student magazine. And whenever she had run out of time before the deadline, or whenever the book in question had been too difficult or too politically contentious for her to know how to describe her own response to it, not only truthfully, but responsibly as well, she'd always taken refuge in excessive praise. People were always quick to criticize an act of criticism, and anybody could dismiss as lazy what professed to be lukewarm. But nobody tended to ask any questions of a gush. Even people who despised whatever book she happened to be praising never quarreled with her if she really, truly rhapsodized about it. They simply wrote her off as a person with poor taste and stopped engaging with her critically, and that was that. The stakes had never been particularly high, of course. But even so, she still felt pain sometimes when she leafed through the back issues of the magazine and saw that all her most lavishly complimentary reviews had been of books whose authors frightened her, books she never finished, or books she'd been too cowardly to admit she didn't understand. With typical self-deprecation, she'd been sure that she was quite alone in giving rein to this particular form of intellectual dishonesty, and so she'd been surprised, several years into her time at Burnham Wood, to realize that one of the clearest signs that Mira was practicing deception of some kind was when she began agreeing with everything that Shelley said. The observation about Dumbledore, for example, was just the kind of rhetorical nicety that in normal circumstances Mira would have loved to take apart and puzzle over. Shelley had first thought of it 2 days ago, and she had been rehearsing and refining it in her mind ever since as she waited for an opportunity to come out with it to Mira offhand. She had hoped that it might prompt a philosophical debate about hard choices, that might then flow quite naturally into a discussion about the future management of Burnham Wood. Timaraneke, she whispered defiantly, though neither she nor Mira had brought that subject up again, and she had decided not to table it, as Mira had suggested, for the consideration of the wider group. Not at least until the next full caucus hui, which was still 2.5 months away. Shelley knew already that there would be no point in trying to revive the subject before then. For ever since that conversation, Mira had been nothing but agreeable towards her, going out of her way to voice her appreciation and her sympathy, backing down at once from any point of difference and steering clear of any issues on which she and Shelley didn't see entirely eye to eye. At the nightly gatherings, she had been uncharacteristically withdrawn, never impolite, but incurious, and distant to the point of disapproval. And several times Shelley had caught her gazing round at the assembled faces with genuine bemusement, almost as though she were seeing Burnham Wood in action for the very first time, seeing them not as herself, perhaps, but as Lemoyne. The dust from the straw bale made Shelley sneeze once,
twice, three times, and she heard Mira say, "Bless you," absently from the other end of the field. Shelley didn't thank her. She rubbed her face bad-temperedly across her sleeve. One of the cautionary tales that Shelley's mother liked to tell at her recruitment seminars concerned a watercolor hobbyist who had once been discovered while painting on a hillside on the Ekaroa Harbor by a prominent figure in the art world, Mrs. Noakes never named him, who had been honeymooning in the country from New York. This important man, Mrs. Noakes narrated, had been so arrested by the modest sketch displayed on the easel of the hobbyist that he had vowed to one day mount an exhibition of her work. He had pressed his business card into her hand and made her promise that she would call him at her earliest convenience. An exhibition was everything the hobbyist had ever dreamed of. And yet for some reason she was filled with abject terror at the thought. And although she kept his card safe in her wallet and took it out every now and then to look at it, somehow she could never bring herself to make the call. Months passed and then years. And then one day she'd happened to come across a mention of the man in an article that she was reading. And she learned that he was dead. And that he had been dead for some time, several years in fact. And this was the final proof that she had missed her chance, that she had undermined her own ambition, and that perversely, contrarily, against her own best interests, against the deepest and most secret wishes of her heart, she had run away from what she most desired. And here Mrs. Noakes would pause and then say, in a solemn tone of voice, that the watercolor hobbyist was her. Total bullshit, Mira had said when she'd first heard the story. That never happened. I bet you $1,000. But it was only now, years later, as Shelley knelt to disperse the loose straw over the ground, that it occurred to her that Mira had rather missed the point. For if the story was made up, then in a way that only made it all the more poignant. For how much more desiring must Mrs. Noakes have been, and how much more perverse and more contrary to have invented it entirely? Shelley Noakes understood self-sabotage. Nothing could have made more sense to her than if Mira had confessed to her that, like Mrs. Noakes, like Shelley, like human beings everywhere, what she had been hiding from Shelley was something she had also been hiding from herself. That she was afraid of Burnham Wood becoming famous, afraid of the money that Lemoyne had offered them, afraid of exposure, afraid of opportunity, afraid of the future, afraid of success. Except that wasn't it, Shelley thought, with bitterness. That wasn't what was really going on. The reason that Mira had been lying to her was even more basic than self-sabotage, and Shelley knew exactly what it was. Shelley had met Robert Lemoyne only once, and the impression she had formed of him was one of smooth and impenetrable courtesy. A man under his own control had been the phrase that had occurred to her, slightly unexpectedly, for she had never thought to describe a person in such a way before. He had studied Shelley's features very closely when they'd shaken hands, just as he'd gone on to scrutinize each member of the group in turn, peering into each of their faces one by one. And as he'd completed his introductions and they'd stood exchanging pleasantries in the livestock pens beside the shearing shed, Shelley had remembered something that Mira had said about him at the Hui. "It's like he's daring us," she'd said. "Or maybe like we're daring him." "Yes," Shelley had thought, assessing him. There was an unrepentant challenge in his manner, a tacit provocation in the way he held himself aloof, and in the way he seemed perpetually, but only ever so slightly, amused. She could not honestly say that she disliked him. He was confident, well-spoken, dryly funny, wicked even. But what had unsettled her was how utterly and obviously Mira was enthralled to him, and how unaware she seemed that her infatuation was something that everyone, he most of all, could see. Shelley had been just starting to wonder, with rising trepidation, what this troubling development might mean for the rest of them at Burnham Wood, when suddenly he'd turned and looked directly at her, raising his eyebrows in taunting expectation and flashing her a grin. Shelley had been so startled that she'd found herself unable to return the smile. She'd simply stared at him, and the thought that had filled her consciousness was not, "It's like he knew what I was thinking," but, "It's like he wanted me to think that he knew what I was thinking," which had felt both much more sinister and, strangely, much more impressive. "You guys haven't slept together, have you?" she'd asked Mira after he'd gone. "What?" Mira had said in a play of bafflement. "No, no way. It just kind of seems like it might be in the air." "Really?" Mira had turned prim. I've never got that impression. Oh, come on, that's not true. Honestly, it's never come up. Yeah, but if it did, though, you'd be keen? I'd be terrified, Mira had replied, starting to laugh. Shelley, you didn't find him terrifying? Like, you didn't think that man is the scariest fucking human that I've ever met in my entire life? And how is it even possible that we are anywhere within a million miles of him? And who the fuck are we? And what does anything mean? By then, Shelley had begun to laugh as well. And then one of the others had asked what was so funny, which had somehow made it even funnier. And soon everyone was laughing at the sheer absurdity of their extraordinary situation. And it hadn't been until several hours later, as Shelley was settling down in her sleeping bag and making her usual mental review of all the conversations she had had that day, that she'd realized that Mira had rather neatly dodged the question. But it wasn't just a question. It wasn't just rhetorical, Shelley thought, raking the ground with her fork, scoring it, pounding it, turning up stones. It was a serious existential problem for the whole of Burnham Wood. And the more she thought about it, the less inclined she felt to laugh. Lemoyne had the power to withdraw his offer on a whim. There was no formal contract in place. If he tired of the arrangement, he could turn around at any point and order Burnham Wood to leave. And then what could they do? Who could they appeal to? The land was his. The power was his. The law would be entirely on his side. Shelley was striking at the ground. Couldn't Mira see that if she slept with him, she would be putting everyone at risk? She would be jeopardizing all their hard work, all the sacrifices they had made to get there, everything that they believed in, and for what? She couldn't seriously believe she had a future with this guy. She knew what he was. She knew that he was toying with her, just like she knew that she was toying with him back. She was just fucking around. She was just doing whatever the hell she wanted, like she had always done, taking everyone else for granted, like she had always done, rebelling for the sake of it, like she had always done, acting as though the rules that bound the little people were just too tiresome and too ordinary to apply to her. And it wasn't like this was anything new, Shelley thought, now with real bitterness. There had always been aspects of the daily management of Burnham Wood that Mira had seen as beneath her. She had always acted as though the administration and the democratic protocols were unworthy of her attention and her time. It was one of the ways in which the two friends perfectly complemented each other. For as Mira had often pointed out to her, Shelley really rather liked bureaucracy. She found genuine fulfillment in ticking items off a list, and organizing and making blueprints for the future, and establishing processes of feedback and methods of appeal. Mira had no patience for any of that. She loved to speculate, loved to feel the scope and flex of her own imaginative audacity, loved to test and contradict herself, to keep enlarging, constantly, her own sense of what it was possible to hypothesize and conjure up and entertain. And although this roving, speculative energy was something Shelley honestly admired and envied about her, she could also see that it amounted, at times, to a kind of capriciousness, even a callousness, when it came to those aspects of mundane existence that could not be posited or wished away. There was a kind of safety in abstraction, Shelley felt, in visions that remained visions, in ideas that remained ideas. And it had occurred to her, in recent days, that maybe it had been the very formlessness of Burnham Wood, as an undeclared, unregulated, sometimes criminal, sometimes philanthropic gathering of friends, that had held Mira's interest in it for so long. She was expecting that her friend was going to find it very difficult, at the point the group officially incorporated, to leave this realm of abstracted possibility behind. If they ever got to that point. They weren't out of the woods yet, Shelley thought, grimly registering the pun. They weren't anywhere close to solvent. It was still a matter of if. And in the meantime, Mira's attitude was starting to become a problem. For even though Burnham Wood was horizontal by design, and even though their meetings were always facilitated on a roster, and even though all the tasks of leadership were scrupulously divvied up and shared, no one could ever quite forget, no one ever did forget, that Mira was the founder. For one thing, she was not a natural follower. But for another, she possessed an authority that could not easily be yielded or rotated to another member of the group. And that was the authority of expertise. When she declined to register an opinion, submitting without comment to the will of the majority, and then silently withdrawing as soon as the meeting was done, Shelley could see that it made the others nervous. They began to second-guess themselves and to pull away from one another, and their work began to suffer. and somehow it always fell to Shelley, as the second longest-serving member of the group, to muster an energy she did not feel, and step into the breach, and fill the gap, and pick up the slack, and make excuses for a friend who wasn't even showing her the simple courtesy of admitting what was glaringly obvious to literally everyone around her, Shelley most of all. Glancing over at her now, Shelley saw that she was scanning the sky above the ridge for what must have been the 100th time that afternoon, and she felt a surge of anger. "I went all in with Burnham Wood," she thought, "and all you wanted was to fuck around." Shelley had long grown accustomed to the expectation that she was fated to be always on the losing side. New Zealand had been governed by the centre-right since before she'd been eligible to vote, and she could find little to excite her in any of the parties supposedly in opposition. A defeated, airless, ugly feeling rose in her whenever she heard a person of her parents' generation talking brightly about home ownership, or foreign holidays, or financial serendipity, or education for its own sake, or second chances in a crowded field. She felt this way sometimes simply if someone spoke about the future, even the very near future, in optimistic terms. But she was not unaware that there was a certain satisfaction to be found in hopelessness, a certain piety, a touch of martyrdom, in feeling oneself and one's entire generation to have been wronged by those in power, and deceived and discouraged from civic participation, and robbed and made fun of and maligned. And when the sound of an aircraft engine split the air, and she looked over to see that Mira had downed her tools and was already striding up the hill towards the airstrip, smiling, Shelley felt disgusted suddenly by her own complacency. She watched the aircraft bank and circle back around to land. And then she heard her mother say, "Lean in." "Wait for me," she called out, pulling off her gloves and jogging up the hill as well. She pretended not to see how Mira hesitated in confusion, her smile faltering and then becoming false as Shelley closed the gap between them. She seemed, Shelley thought, almost ashamed, almost cowed, as if Shelley had exposed her in a lie. But she said nothing. She just nodded, still smiling, and the two friends fell into step without another word. The plane had landed and taxied to a halt by the time they reached the airstrip, and Lemoyne was getting out. He didn't seem surprised to see the pair of them approaching. But then, Shelley thought, perhaps he never seemed surprised. It was an emotion that she couldn't picture on his face somehow.
"I've been in California," he said by way of a greeting. "I brought you something."
He took a Ziploc bag out of his pocket and held it up so they could see what it contained. A tiny piece of watercolor paper, barely bigger than a bus ticket, divided into squares like a miniature loyalty card. Each square was the size of a fingernail and had been stamped with a turquoise five-pointed star. Shelley didn't know what it was. She glanced at Mira for assistance. Mira was already shaking her head and holding up both hands.
"No thanks," she said. "Not for me."
He held it out to her.
"It's a housewarming present."
"Shed warming," Mira corrected him. She crossed her arms. Lemoyne grinned at her.
"Shed and house," he said, passing the bag to Shelley instead. "I'm going to stay over. I thought we could all sample some of this together."
Mira scowled at him.
"What, you don't drink but you do acid?"
So that was what it was. Shelley examined the bag with new interest.
"Ever tried it?" said Lemoyne.
He was addressing Shelley, but Mira answered,
"No."
Lemoyne was still waiting for Shelley's answer. "I read an article about it," Shelley said. He burst out laughing.
"What was that like?" he said. "Lots of colorful language, lots of made-up words and new kinds of grammar."
"I don't remember any specific words," Shelley said. And he laughed again and said,
"Superb."
She felt a flush of pleasure. "It did make me want to try it, though," she said.
"Everyone should try it once," he said,
reaching back into the cockpit for a duffel bag.
"We use it all the time with startups, as a way of building trust among a group, a kind of bonding exercise."
"Cool," Shelley said, still flushed.
"It's amazing what it does to the imagination," said Lemoyne. "Even just a taste, doesn't have to be a full trip. It just brings you into the moment, you know, sharpens you up. Makes you more present, more connected, more creative. You're going to love it."
Mira was scowling again. "Sounds like someone's paying you to say that."
"No," he said. That's the beauty of illicit substances. No advertising. You can make a pure decision for once in your life. No packaging, no algorithm, no big pharma shoving it down your throat.
Just some guy in a tracksuit telling us how much we're going to love it, Mira said. It seemed to Shelley that Lemoyne's expression tightened slightly. Mira must have sensed that she had overstepped the mark, for she quickly turned away, narrowing her eyes and looking out over the valley, as if she'd heard a sound in the distance and she couldn't quite place what it might be. Shelley recognized the habit. This was something Mira did when she had been embarrassed. She was trying to hide her face.
Well, Lemoyne said to Shelley, you can't please everybody.
Mira was still turned away. People did it who were colorblind, Shelley said. In the article I read. And they saw colors for the first time. It was kind of beautiful, actually.
She tried to give the Ziploc bag back to him, but he shook his head.
It's for you, he said, gazing at her. Shelley, right?
Yeah,
Shelley said, astonished.
It's for everyone, he said. Socialism. See? I get it.
He dropped the duffel bag on the ground and went back into the cockpit to retrieve an aluminium cooler that he had stored behind the pilot's seat. Shelley glanced at Mira, but she was examining a cut on the side of one of her fingers.
I brought dinner, Lemoyne said when he reemerged. I thought we'd make a night of it. Relax. Get to know each other.
He set the cooler down, slung the duffel bag on top of it, and then picked it up again.
Do you need help carrying that? Shelley said.
At the same time as Mira said, so what's for dinner?
She was trying too hard to be caustic, Shelley thought, and it was coming off only as rude.
Lemoyne answered Shelley.
That's very good of you, he said,
slipping the duffel bag off his shoulder and handing her the cooler.
Why don't you take that down to the camp and round up the others? Tell them we'll be down in just a moment.
He was giving her the brush off, but he touched her arm as he spoke and smiled, and Shelley knew that she had won. With a final glance at Mira, who was looking at the ground, she set off down the hill towards the shearing shed, and once she was out of sight of the plane, she set the cooler down on the ground and opened it to see what it contained. Inside was stacked plastic tubes, each containing a preparation of a different ingredient. Fat, silky noodles, chopped peanuts, lime wedges, mung beans, sliced onions tossed in oil, diced chili peppers, batons of tofu. There were two flasks, one filled with a thick, golden-brown sauce, the other with what looked like beaten egg. It was a pad thai, Shelley realized, feeling oddly touched. A good choice for a group. A crowd-pleaser, vegetarian too. Of course, there was no earthly chance that he'd prepared the ingredients himself. Undoubtedly, he'd have a private chef. But Shelley felt a tenderness towards him all the same. She put everything back in the cooler and replaced the lid. She found the others in the livestock pens, building a frame for bird netting.
How's our money man?
Hayden said as she approached.
He's going to join us for dinner, Shelley said, hoisting up the cooler. Pad Thai.
Aw, he cooked for us, said Natalie. He didn't have to do that.
He also brought us a housewarming present, Shelley said, reaching into her pocket for the Ziploc bag.
A present?
Yeah, said Shelley, holding it up.
It's an absolute shitload of Class A drugs.
They all started laughing, and after a moment, Shelley did too.
Awesome, Hayden said.